This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 82.
Michael and I do a lot of work at JAJ to ensure that we've got the right leaders in the top of the organization and that their succession is robust and diverse and we have choice. And a large part of that in the pivoting part is making sure that our leaders have varied experience, different geographies, different functions, different businesses. And the reason we're so focused on that is because ultimately, when you're making a selection decision, you're making a prediction. Can someone do a job in a set of conditions that they haven't faced identically before? And so we throw a lot of things at people with different experiences and we pivot them laterally. We pivot them to different geographies. And by the way, many times it's not up, it's across, it's a lattice. Pivoting is about learning and it's about making sure that your experiences are highly varied so that the company and yourself can remain competitive for situations you haven't faced before.
What does it mean to be a built-to-last company like Johnson & Johnson? How can you build a talent pipeline that produces a deep bench of leaders? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. In today's episode, we'll be talking about how CHROs can best partner with their heads of talent and what it takes to develop leaders at scale. And if you are a CHRO, then you are likely thinking about how to build your talent pipeline. And research by the Institute for Corporate Productivity, also known as I4CP, in their 2024 Priorities and Predictions Report, found that leadership effectiveness was cited by CHROs as their organization's biggest weakness. To address this gap and improve business performance, many leading CHROs had leadership development and training leaders at all levels as their number one priority for 2024. Luckily, my guests this week, Peter Fasolo and Michael Arrett, know a thing or two about building leaders at scale in a values-based organization. Peter is the Executive Vice President and CHRO of Johnson & Johnson, where he's responsible for global talent, recruiting, diversity and inclusion, compensation, benefits, employee relations, and all aspects of human resources agenda for Johnson & Johnson. He's also a member of the Executive Committee, Management Compensation Committee, and Chairman of the Pension and Benefits Committee. Peter also serves on the boards of the Human Resources Policy Association in Washington, D.C., Tufts University, and Save the Children. And he was named as a Fellow of the National Academy of Human Resources in 2017, which is the highest honor in our field. Joining Peter is Michael, who's as head of global talent management at Johnson & Johnson. In this role, Michael oversees succession management, talent development, talent acquisition, talent mobility, performance management, assessment, and workforce analytics. Simply put, Michael's key responsibility is ensuring the organization and its leaders are prepared for the future. Michael's also a frequent speaker and recognized thought leader in talent management. And I have to personally thank Michael for his role in making today's episode happen. Originally, it was just going to be Michael on this podcast, but as we talked about the potential topics for our conversation, we both realized how important the relationship is between a CHRO and a head of talent and how that really matters if you want to unlock the value of talent in your organization. And since Michael not only works for one of the best CHROs in the world, but also has a great partnership with him, we thought, why not invite Peter to be on the podcast as well so we can go deep on a CHRO and head of talent relationship and understand how they can work together to build talent pipelines. During my conversation with Peter and Michael, we're going to discuss the power of Johnson & Johnson's credo and how it has served as the organization's North Star for over 135 years, how CHROs and heads of talent can partner to create value for their organizations, why talent leaders need to have a point of view on the top 100 leaders in their organization, why every HR professional needs to think about their job in terms of the outcomes they deliver, how J&J is personalizing career journeys and using skills as a foundation for their mentoring programs, and how generative AI and the digital transformation of work will impact every organization's people strategies, and much, much more. Peter, Michael, welcome to Future of HR Podcast. How are you both doing?
Doing terrific, JP. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us, JP. Excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have not just one amazing HR leader, but two amazing HR leaders on the podcast. So it's a two-for-one special, and we're going to talk about Johnson & Johnson, the future of work and talent, and that special relationship between a CHRO and that chief talent officer. But Peter, I want to start with you. Johnson & Johnson has been putting the needs and well-being of people first for over 135 years. It's truly an incredible company. At the core of Johnson & Johnson is your credo, which you call the North Star for the organization. Can you share more about J&J's credo and why values matter in building great organizations?
Well, JP, first of all, thanks for having us. I think it's very appropriate you start a conversation about Johnson & Johnson with our credo. J&J is a classic built-to-last company where we've been in existence for well over 135 years. And our credo, interestingly enough, we did celebrate our 80th anniversary of our credo just this past year. The essence of our credo is essentially servant leadership. This very simple document that was written, as I said, 80 years ago, a little over 300 words, where the word must is embedded in it over 28 times, is simply a guidepost. And as you say, a North Star for a company like J&J. How do you keep 140,000 associates across multiple businesses in the largest, most diversified healthcare company that serves a billion patients a day, operates in 65 different countries. How do you keep that all together and feel confident that the thousands upon thousands of decisions that are being made every day by your associates are in a place where you're serving patients in the best possible way? Well, you need a North Star. The essence of our credo is a set of stakeholders that we feel very responsible to serve. First and foremost, it's our patients, our mothers, fathers, caregivers, healthcare providers that we have the privilege to serve every day. It's our employees who expect a fair and equitable work environment that's diverse, where they can bring their whole selves to work. We have to give back to our communities. And if we do those things in that order, the shareholder should get a fair return. It is about servant leadership. It's about dilemmas and ethical decision-making, because leaders have to make trade-offs all the time between going into new markets, making sure they're efficient, giving back to shareholders, and making sure we get market access to people who need our products and services at a fair or lowered price. These are trade-offs. And our credo is our guidepost. It's our North Star. And the last thing I'd say, JP, about our credo is the reason it's so alive in our company is because we work it every day. We survey our employees. Are we living up to those expectations? We reward our leaders who embody our credo in those moments of truth when we promote them or when we pay them along the way. We ask our associates, when we're not living up to our credo, what do we need to do to get even better? So you have to work it, and you have to ensure that the philosophy finds its way every day in operating rhythms of a company of our size.
I'm so glad you really went to that last point, Peter, because so many companies have values, they've got a mission, but they're not Johnson & Johnson, right? And 300 words only matters if everyone is really bought in and the leaders really put their money where their mouth is, right? And every day, and you're asking those questions. And so that's tremendous. And I think that's really what makes Johnson & Johnson so special is, in really, if you think about a lot of incredible organizations, their values aren't just words on the wall. They are actions and how leaders get rewarded, how we think about this in terms of the customers and how we work and make decisions. And so it's just incredible. Thank you for going through that. And I'll make sure I copy back and a link out to the credo, because people will want to read through that. Only 300 words.
143.
Yeah, and JP, we've revised our credo, what, Michael, I think three times in our history, and the last time was about 5 years ago, or maybe a little bit longer. I'm proud to say that the second paragraph that embodies our employees was the one that got the most engagement and revisions and modernization around diversity, equity, inclusion, making sure that management is fully equipped to have the skills required to do their jobs. And I love our credo. I love all four paragraphs. I'm a bit partial to the second one that talks about our great associates around the globe.
Well, I think creating a culture of belonging and being inclusive is critical in our world today. Now, Michael, switching gears a little bit, in your role as global head of talent management, you often get asked, how do I get ahead in my career? How do you answer that for early HR career professionals?
As with anything in the jobs that Peter and I are in, you take a really complex question like that. How do I get ahead? And you try to simplify it. And JP, although you sort of said maybe it's a little bit of a divergent question, it's actually somewhat connected to that second paragraph, which is the one focused on our employees, because that gives us a guide organizationally around what are the conditions we want to create for our employees. So it's things like an equal opportunity for development, advancement, employment. All individuals must be treated as such with dignity and respect. So when I get this question in terms of trying to simplify it, I think a little bit formulaically, just so people can remember. And I think about a couple different pieces of advice. And I think the first is moving ahead, there's a little bit of a prerequisite or ticket of entry, which is you should be performing in your job. Sometimes isn't the case. Maybe someone's in the wrong job or isn't their skills aren't aligned to that. And it's a little bit of a joint responsibility to position them for success. But by and large, in order to be able to do something different, you need to demonstrate that you've performed in the places that you've been. A couple of these things may be a little bit out of your control. One is timing. So I think it's having a recognition of advice or a recognition as I give employees this advice that sometimes that perfect great development and growth opportunity shows up and it's not the right time. Maybe you just start a new job. Maybe there's something going on in a positive way personally. Maybe you just moved, whatever it would be. Sometimes that doesn't always sync up. And I think you need to acknowledge that. The third thing I tell people is always think about your backfill strategy. I tell this to interns. You can be in the company for a week. Always think through how's the work going to get done so that I can be freed up to do something more different, whether it's a project, whether it's getting exposure to different places, or whether it's a wholesale new job. How's the work going to continue on? The fourth is always thinking about competition and differentiation. And by and large, what is the individual's strengths? What are their superpowers? What are the things that they can contribute and bring and the value that they derive that's really differentiated from everyone else that will help set them up for success? And then lastly is, I call it sort of an ecosystem or a support network, which is really important. At J&J, as with many companies, I would suspect, we invite the employees to take an ownership role or a lead role in their own development. But if you think about that person driving the car, they're driving the car. We want to fill that car with co-pilots and support and whoever might be needed to help support them in that. Sometimes that means having mentors or coaches inside the company, outside the company, but people that can serve as a little bit of an internal board of director to help be able to provide navigation, guidance, counseling, coaching along that incredible journey.
Great advice. Peter, anything you'd add to that?
I just want to pick up on something Michael laid out. I think he's hit all the right key points. Michael does a terrific job coaching and directing our leaders accordingly to that framework. This notion of timing, I think, is really important. And it links back a little bit to your question on our credo. I often have observed in my career that people have timetables and organizations have timetables. They seldom match up. And the only way you can ensure that the individual is staying in the game with you and the organization is staying in the game is trust. If the timing's not right, but I have a authentic, real, and trusting relationship with my manager or my leader, and there's coaching and sponsorship along the way, then the system works. Now, at some point, the sand runs out of the hourglass. So I'm not naive that you can't do that forever. But I think Michael's right in terms of timing, because companies have rhythms of organizational changes and businesses. Many times individuals are anxious to move on and to do other things because they have the performance track record or the potential, but the opportunity has to be there. And again, the trust between two people and the company is really, really critical for the leadership development and succession rhythms to really work.
That's a great point. And I think if you trust your manager, you're respected, you're doing good work, you like the company, it's aligned with your values, and maybe you feel like your clock is ticking, going and having that conversation with your leader and saying, look, I feel like I'm ready. And hopefully they can then say to you, look, we think you're ready too. We just don't have the opportunity. Stick with us. That's how you keep the high performers, high potentials, by having those conversations. Because if you don't have the conversation, they listen to the recruiters that call, right?
Or absolutely.
Peter, you also talked about this before. You said the careers are never static. And eventually we all have to make a pivot. Tell us more about why you feel this way and what you meant by that.
When I think about careers, I think about them from a theory of the case around learning and constantly striving to ensure your skills and your experiences keep you competitive within the organization or within your profession or within your industry. And what I have found over decades in working with terrific leaders in companies like J&J and others is successful leaders and ones that perhaps derail or falter, they have a lot of characteristics in common, for sure. Both groups may be smart. Both groups may be ambitious. But the ones that are able to pivot and continue to soar on, they have experiences that are highly varied. Their interpersonal skills tend to be pretty honed. They're more solution-oriented than blame-oriented when problems occur. And they're as comfortable in the boardroom as they are on the shop floor. Now, Michael and I do a lot of work at J&J to ensure that we've got the right leaders in the top of the organization and that their succession is robust and diverse and we have choice. And a large part of that in the pivoting part is making sure that our leaders have varied experience, different geographies, different functions, different businesses. And the reason we're so focused on that is because ultimately, when you're making a selection decision, you're making a prediction. Can someone do a job in a set of conditions that they haven't faced identically before? You gain greater probability or gain greater competence that an individual will be able to do that role when they've seen a lot of different things. They're really gifted with other people, that they can surround themselves with diverse teams, and that they're teachers. And so we throw a lot of things at people with different experiences and we pivot them laterally. We pivot them to different geographies. And by the way, many times it's not up, it's across, it's a lattice, it's over here, it's a different set of experiences. So pivoting is about learning and it's about making sure that your experiences are highly varied so that the company and yourself can remain competitive for situations you haven't faced before.
Well, I love that you're bringing that up and I love the way that you described it. It's the same way I think about it when you're making that prediction, because a lot of times we're saying, does this person know what to do when they don't know what to do in this new situation? And the only way to know that is if they have a track record of being successful in these unproven situations. But more importantly, in our field, we talk about the 70-20-10. 70% of our development comes from experiences, but we spend a lot of our time on talking about the 10%. Yeah. Which is the mistake. And I think Johnson & Johnson does it better than most around thinking about assignment methodology and management. So it's a great point you brought up. Hey, everyone. After a quick break, Peter, Michael, and I will be right back to discuss how CHROs and heads of talent should partner, how to develop leaders across your organization, and how they are preparing J&J for the future of work. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. The Institute for the Future recently came out with a report that said 85% of jobs that will exist in 2030 haven't been invented yet. While I can't predict the future, I am certain that the only way to future-proof your career is by learning to learn. This applies to our organizations as well, and as HR leaders, our job is to ensure our team members have the skills and capabilities needed now and in the future. This is why I'm excited to announce the Future of HR podcast is now sponsored by Biz Library. Biz Library is the place where learning happens. They're your one-stop shop for all of your compliance, upskilling needs, and leadership development challenges. BizLibrary is an industry leader for high-quality, off-the-shelf content that will solve your compliance needs, support the upskilling of teams, and will help your leaders to lead. If you're looking to elevate learning in your organization, give BizLibrary a call as they can support you with their innovative L&D platforms, best-in-class content, and unrivaled strategic support. And if you mention that JP at the Future of HR podcast sent you, you'll receive a 10% discount on year one of your BizLibrary contract. So head on over to bizlibrary.com and see how they can help you to elevate learning in your organization today. Let's transition a little bit now talking to this amazing relationship of the CHRO and the Chief Talent Officer. And I'm going to acknowledge, look, business and HR is a team sport. There's a head of total rewards, head of diversity, head of HR business partners. All those roles are super critical. But since I've got you both, I want you to talk about what it's like to work with your CHRO and your head of talent and how they should work together. And so, Peter, let's start with you. How do you think about talent and how does having a talent function really create value for the organization and its team members? Let's start there.
Well, JP, you're right to say that all team members across the CHRO spectrum serve different objectives, purpose on behalf of the associates we serve. I think the relationship between CHRO and the Chief Talent Officer, and Michael and I have been working together. We've worked together for decades, and Michael and I have been in this capacity together as partners for over 5 years, Michael, I think, at least. It's a really, really important relationship on a couple of dimensions. Look, at the end of the day, ultimately, the game that we're in the people agenda for corporations is about picking winners and putting people in jobs, making sure that we've got diverse teams, because cultures are shaped in large part by the decisions we make with individuals in key leadership positions. If you get it right, your culture and your mission soars on, energy is created. If you get it wrong, then it's set back and you go, obviously you go backwards. So Michael and I with the team spend a lot of time on making sure that the performance and the potential of the key roles across Johnson & Johnson have the right leaders in place. And as importantly, that the key succession is there. So Michael and I may spend most of our time disproportionately on roughly the top 150 jobs across Johnson & Johnson that we deem as critically important to the enterprise. And we spend a lot of our time making sure that succession is there. The leadership development machinery of J&J from the bottom of the pyramid to the middle to the top works in large part because Michael and his team have programmatic interventions. They help us top grade. They ensure that we see individuals who are coming up through the ranks that have the learning agility. And then what Michael and I do together, Michael has a gift of really knowing how to run the talent management approach, the philosophy, but he's also a coach. He's a developer. He knows how to ensure that his team is making sure that our teams across J&J are working collectively on common approaches. So yes, the machinery's there, the operating rhythms are there, the leadership development programmatic interventions are there, but you also have to have teams around you. And Michael has that through his ranks of coaches, of great assessors, of people who are outstanding in analytics and outcomes. So the theory of the case is philosophy and rhythms, but it's also making sure that the skill sets of the people at your talent organization can serve the company well.
So well said, Peter. Very helpful to hear that. And Johnson & Johnson has a best-in-class talent function. Talent, obviously, is really critical at Johnson & Johnson and his other companies. So that was helpful to hear how you think about that. High praise, Michael. So you're probably feeling pretty good right now. I don't know where the performance management landed for this year, that performance review conversation, but that was pretty good. So I'll give you the transcript. If you
need. Just needs the expectations keep going higher, JP. That's what happened.
If this podcast did have a video component, the shirt would be bursting with, I mean, that was very kind. Yes, very kind.
That was great. And Michael, turning to you, there are CHROs out there who have got their head of talent. They're like, how do I get more out of my head of talent? And what should I expect? Going back to Peter's point of expecting more every year and raising that bar. How do you think about that?
You know, I'm not sure if there's a one-size-fits-all formula, similar to the last question around the formula for progression or whatnot. I would just say I'm in an incredibly fortunate position. I think about conditions for success in that I have known Peter for decades, and he went from someone who I admired and revered to someone I'm now working for. And similar to you, JP, he worked both the talent role and the head of HR people leader role. Peter spent many years cutting his teeth in the talent space over multiple companies. So from a learning perspective and an understanding, and now having been in the CHRO role for a significant duration, I think there's a huge appreciation for the role and the value that it can bring. As Peter said, for those, and I think there's probably many experts on the podcast, I view the head of talent role as being a bit binary. There's two parts to it. So one is running this big talent machine. How do you set the strategy and deliver upon recruiting and moving people and learning and development, et cetera? And then there's another part, which is the top of the house succession management, analytics, assessment, which is much more narrow in terms of focus. And I think there is a proximity effect. The way Peter and I work is our office is 15 yards apart. There's a lot of organic and informal ways in which we work. And one thing I would say, and again, it's the privilege, is I can't think of many examples where Peter tells me no. I'll have an idea. I'll have a question. Now listen, he's been in the trenches long enough to probably have a pretty good sense of what is going to work. But to his credit, I think he allows me to go through the journey and guide and direct me so that even if it doesn't work, there's incredible learning along the way. But between the two of us, there's things that we work on together. There's things where we divide and conquer. But at the end of the day, it's sort of what Peter sort of references, the obligation that we have to ensure that our company has lots of choices with regards to talent so that we have continuity and we don't have gaps, especially in critical positions defined more broadly. The last thing I'll say, and I'm not sure if this is the right placement of this, but I'm dying to tell this story. And I don't know if even too many people at J&J know it, but in terms of kind of the now manager and leader, employee, employer relationship and me reporting to Peter, I can remember before I was in this job, getting a call from Peter, and we hadn't been working as closely together. And he invited me. He said, hey, I've got to sadly do a trip this weekend. We had an employee who, in a terrible tragedy, lost her life through a natural disaster. It pains me to even bring this up, but it was a really horrible thing. And Peter invited me to join him over the weekend to go out to Cincinnati to honor this employee with some of their coworkers. And we enabled a scholarship in their name. We spent a full day just listening and offering our condolences. And Peter never said this directly, but in terms of teaching, there was never a direct quote, which is, this is how we do things around here, Michael. But it was almost implicit, which is as you get into senior jobs, especially in HR at J&J, this is how we do things around here. We really care for our people on a very different level. And when things go great, we're there to high five and pat on the back. And when things are hard, it's equally or even more important that we're there for them then. So just maybe a little antidote around this really incredible position I'm in reporting to Peter.
It's an incredible story. And it shows just, again, what J&J is all about, right? But also I think that you guys have built incredible trust. I think that's really important in that CHRO, CTO relationship, and frankly, across the entire executive team.
On that point of trust, which again is a bit of a thread so far in some of our discussions, the relationship between a CHRO and any of his or her direct reports, but certainly with the head of talent, there needs to be this unvarnished dialogue. We're making some very serious decisions. We're giving our advice to members of our executive committee, their directs, our business unit HR community. Michael and I and his team have to be very comfortable with each other sharing views, being fact-based. And then to Michael's point, sometimes just being practical about where you need to make decisions. I think Michael and I have that where we can just dialogue over around a table and say, yes, this may be the ideal answer, but we've got to go with the less ideal because these set of circumstances bring us in that direction. So let's be aware of and let's go and fight another day on this topic. You have to have that kind of relationship. The other thing I'd say too around the talent management piece, we have an incredible group of business unit HR leaders across J&J, and I'm so proud of all of them and the work that they do. They essentially view their job in large part as talent people. They're the ones out in the operations picking individuals and promoting and making sure the diversity agenda is alive. And I'm just really biased towards having business unit HR people and those in the talent management space be very simpatico, because it happens at the field level. It's at the field level, and they're making those decisions every day. And if they've got a lens on how to assess and develop and coach, that's a multiplier effect.
So you're so right. And I think it's really about where I've seen the best talent programs come to life is when you're co-creating that with the HR business partners. It is a collaboration and co-creation, because sometimes the talent leaders can be a little bit pie in the sky, a little bit theoretical. And we're like, we don't really know what it's like on the floor, on the factory floor or with the leaders. And so we have to have that reality. And you also have to make sure it's going to land. And that's your customers, the HR business partners. So I think that's a great point to bring up. But I also appreciate you, Peter, just talking about the fact that you need Michael to be able to be honest with you, a truth teller. And that relationship's really critical, because you may want to say, well, what do you think about this leader? And you don't want Michael to maybe not give you the full truth or kind of, sugarcoat it. You're like, no, this person's not the right person, or this is the right person. Here's why. You don't have to agree with him, but you're going to want that from your chief talent officer. It's so important to have someone who's going to be able to speak objective truths in those moments.
I learned through my career and working with some terrific leaders when I was either in a talent position or in a business unit HR position at the divisional level. I learned from some great leaders who would often give me the permission to provide my opinions or views or assessments about individuals perhaps we were talking about, and giving me the latitude to provide that kind. And Michael and I do that with our senior leaders. Oftentimes I'll say, look, here's my view on this, but Michael has a different view and you ought to hear it. And I think the more people can hear different views, and then ultimately a line leader has to make a decision on where they want to go, but there's got to be trust along the way to do that.
And JP, maybe your earlier point, it's a little bit philosophical, and part of it comes from being the largest and broadest healthcare company in the world, and the amount of opportunities we have is just sort of picking up on an earlier theme you brought in, is the power that comes from working across different parts of the company. The job that I'm in now is the first job I've ever done that's been a back-to-back job in talent. I've always bounced back and forth, the UHR talent. I think Peter's done the same. I think you've done some of that same, JP. So I think with that business proximity and the close partnership with BUHR, knowing they are closest to the vast majority of talent, is really important. I remember when I first started in this job, as we're talking about, what do you need to do to be successful in this role? I remember Peter saying, we got to hone in on, call it the top 150 people in the company, because you can be a head of talent that is administering processes, succession management, performance management, the rhythms of the company. But there's a true value when you know the talent to that depth that you can have a perspective beyond the assessments and the data that kind of comes in. And I think that partly comes into the coaching piece too, which is how can we support our BUHR and other leaders with incremental support? It's advice that I give my own team as they come in, as the levels I have heads of talent for each of our sectors, which is make sure you know the talent, get to know the talent.
Really, really important advice, because you really can't make that prediction. And you also can't get to build the trust, know the business, if you don't know the people. So I think it's just great, great point, Michael. Let's talk about the future of work. It's a hot topic. We always talk about the future of work. We're always interested in where things are going. But Peter, I wanted to maybe give you a little bit of a different take. And when it comes to the future of work, what are the top four things that CEOs need to hear and should be thinking about?
The future of work, or new ways of working, is an area for those in our profession that will shape in the next five, I'd say the next 5 years, as one of the most important topics. So let's peel underneath that a little bit. So when I think about the future of work, one of the first things that we need to really make sure as HR professionals we're on top of is the digital transformation of the people agendas in our companies. And I would encourage all of your listeners of your great podcast to really ensure that they're thinking about their jobs with technology and AI and digital in mind, because it is disrupting companies. It's certainly reshaping the HR field. We see it profoundly in talent acquisition. We see it very fast moving in our total reward space. I think that's extraordinarily exciting, because it allows us not only to be more efficient, but to use analytics and insights and to pool information to provide decision makers on what's really happening in your organization. So we do a lot of employee listening. We use large language models so that we can ensure that we are providing insights to our business leaders. We are using AI and machine learning in talent acquisition now. And what it's doing is it's freeing up capacity for our HR leaders to do even higher level coaching and leadership along the way. So digital is really, really important. Every HR professional needs to think about their job in terms of analytics and outcomes. Michael is exactly right. None of us should be rewarded for process. We should be rewarded for outcomes. Who'd you hire? Who'd you promote? What's the diversity of your team? What's the innovation of your group? What's the mood in your units? Those are outcomes. Too often, there's still too much variability in our profession on what good looks like. We should be really, really honed in as HR professionals that our scorecards, no matter who you are, has to be outcomes focused. We've built out a world-class data sciences and people analytics group underneath Michael over years. They are helping me get smarter from descriptive to now predictive. They're pooling information. We have data lakes that we're pulling together. We're applying AI and ChatGPT so we can get smarter for employee listening. We have now in the hands of all of our business unit HR people, digital tools so they know what's going on in real time in their organization, promotion rates, diversity, rhythms in their units, employee relations trends, outcomes, 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 not process. So we have one way of doing P&D. We have one way of doing total rewards. We have a variety of different ways of doing things, leadership development, but there's got to be one outcome. So think digital, think analytics, and then certainly you've got to be global in your thinking and you have to ensure that at the end of the day, our job as HR leaders is to support our business leaders to grow their business, to be more efficient, to grab market share, serve more customers and patients. And we should be measured not by our HR outcomes, but by how well we are helping drive top line, bottom line, balance sheet issues, customers served, patients served. Ultimately, we are there to make sure that those values are created, not our own people outcomes. Our people outcomes are important, but they are there to serve the ultimate P&L and higher order customer and patient agenda for our corporation. And getting those skills right and making sure that you're comfortable in that space is really, really important for all of us to ensure that we're keeping our game up.
Really helpful, Peter, to understand and reminding us about why we exist to make the business successful, right? To get the talent and capabilities for us to win. But now it's really through digital, really embracing that and freeing up space, being smart about how we work, and then really delivering on outcomes versus processes, which we get stuck a lot in HR. We get excited about the processes and smile sheets and someone took a course, but did it actually do something? Did it actually help the business?
There's a great article, Michael and I talk about it all the time. It was written years ago, entitled "Beware of the Busy Executive." Just because you're busy doesn't mean anything. What are the outcomes? And I often remind myself is what are the 3 to 5 things that are critical we have to deliver on this year as an HR team and stay focused on that and not get distracted by the level of activities that people will come in many times and try to distract you from the agenda. Our job is to stay true on the outcomes that we're here to deliver.
Absolutely. Now, Michael, you are at the forefront of those couple of big trends, right? Personalization, use of technology, going more digital. Give us your point of view on the future of work or the new ways of working and how that's impacting your team and how you're implementing that at J&J.
As a practice, as an HR practice, from where we've come from to where we are now, I can't think of a more exciting time. As you know, in the world of talent, for many, many years, I think we've had great success, but I would call it in a more differentiated way. So we would hone in on elements of, or different segments, I think, of the employee base differentially, whether they be executives or high potentials or early in career leadership development programs, et cetera. With the advent of data and technology and how quickly it is progressing, I'm really excited about where we stand and being able to provide, as our creative stipulates, sort of this equal opportunity for development and advancement. to create these really highly personalized consumer grade experiences for each and every one of the 135,000 employees that work for J&J in ways that we haven't been able to before. At the end of the day, I think about whether it's in a candidate or employee, fundamentally, they want to learn and grow. And there's places like Johnson & Johnson where I'd venture to say we have as many, if not more, development and growth opportunities as any company in the world. The challenge has always been that we're quickly sort of getting ahead of is how do you make it easy to connect all those people that want to learn and grow with all those opportunities? So even over the last couple of years, some of the advancements we made is in 2022, we launched what we call J&J Learn. In essence, that's a digital talent marketplace that invites our employees into this ecosystem to share their skills and, very importantly, their aspirations. It's not one size fits all. Everyone's got different motives and preferences. So once we have about 10 minutes of engagement of our employee in terms of them sharing information with us, we can then set them on a personalized path for learning and development, which includes a Netflix-like experience, which personalizes their own learning, sort of catalogs through different channels and tiles, videos, classes, online learning, readings, et cetera. We connect people to mentors, and not mentors in the classical sense of someone that's just going to give you generalized feedback, but mentors that are rooted in skills. So based on the skills you want to develop, who are some of the experts in the company that possess those skills? And how can we create a mentor relationship? And that's a little bit unique to J&J. It's a pay it forward in that we're all teachers and we're all learners at J&J. I'm going to be both a mentee and a mentor. So I'll get something, I'll give something. The third is gigs. These are projects and gigs that are outside the scope of your current job. And then beginning in January of this year, we launched a new capability called Career Journeys. So again, based on those skills and aspirations, we give all of our employees a visualization of how their career can grow. So to your first question, when people ask, how can your career grow? I give you my opinion. You can also get into the technology and get a starting point to discuss with your manager, which is based on where you are and where you want to be. Here's different pathways you can go. And by the way, along those pathways, here are the skills that would be required. And here's where you sit right now. And here's a plan to start to bridge that so you can be more competitive. That's maybe just one example, because you're right. Technology data is going to lend itself to personalization, automation, simplification that is going to improve the experience for our candidates and employees. It's also, by the way, going to help us organizationally do some of the work we need to do better in terms of workforce planning and ensuring that we are as competitive as we can be as it relates to different drivers for why people stay at J&J and want to join J&J. And as I said, things are moving so fast. The last couple of years for us has been, we're doing things that we maybe only could dream of several years before.
The other thing I would just add to what Michael's laying out and to your very good question on the future of work, and I've listened to other parts of your podcast where your guests have talked about this, but it's worth reminding all of us, the role of the manager has always been important in companies. Now, companies like J&J or any major corporation have to continue to invest behind their people managers. Why do I say that? Because the future of work now requires the people managers to be on the front lines with their staffs, where they came out of the pandemic with resorting expectations personally, financially, and career-wise. So we know that. Teams are distributed more globally. There's so much coming at managers now externally, from social media to the external world, things that you have to speak on that are outside of work, and all of the things that Michael just talked about with respect to digitization of learning. There's a lot coming at our managers. We've got to really help them not only do the traditional things of setting expectations and coaching and feedback and being very good at staffing, et cetera, but what does it mean to show up every day with energy and the authenticity and the confidence to be able to surround yourself with a team where you can say, I don't know how to solve this one. How do we do this? And be really comfortable with that and be really open and authentic, because I can give all the great speeches and we can do all these great policies. At the end of the day, the rubber meets the road at the field level between managers and his or her direct reports that create an environment for these things to come to life. And managers have a lot coming at them. And I have a high regard for our managers and what they do every day. And I feel a real responsibility to make sure they have what they need to be successful.
It's a really important reminder in the importance of people leaders, especially as we get more high tech, we need more high touch. It's not going to go away. But Michael, also just thank you for painting a vision of what the future of learning can be. It sounds like you are democratizing development and empowering people to do that. And I'm sure your journey is not done. A lot of people might be listening and saying, oh my gosh, can I be J&J? They've got it figured out. I know you probably haven't. There's even more innovations, but it sounds like an amazing foundation of what the future can hold for learning. Last question for you both. I'm going to start with Michael. What is one word or phrase you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
That is a tough one, JP. I might default to a phrase I love, and it's from a science fiction author, William Gibson, which is, the future is here. It's just not evenly distributed. I think to your earlier part, it may sound as if we've got it all figured out at J&J, and I'm really proud of where we are. I feel like we're at the cutting edge, but we're still learning. There's lots of different innovation ahead. And I think the exciting part of this is, as HR practitioners, I'd venture to say one thing we all have in common for the listeners of your podcast and all of us is, at the end of the day, we got into this game and continue to be in this game because, as Peter said, we want to serve, right? We want to help other people. We want to help organizations be successful. We want people to be satisfied in their careers. Following through that spirit is, there is, I am sure, amongst your listeners, some of the most incredible work in the world going on. It's just not evenly distributed. So how do we use forums like this as podcasts as a means to share information or being able to connect sort of outside or through conferences or just broadening the network so we can really understand what is the future and how can we bring it in? Because it's everywhere, right? As I said, the things that we only dreamed about 5, 10 years ago are realities now and fast becoming realities. And what that means is we can provide better employment experiences for our people. And organizationally, we can de-risk and maybe make some smarter decisions around how we structure organizations and the type of talent that will be successful in roles in ways that we've never been able to do before.
Peter, your take.
It's a great question, JP. I want HR professionals to be caring, and I want them to have the courage and the support to drive great outcomes for the entities that they serve. I spent a lot of my time with the teams on lots of different business issues, but I'm constantly filtering the dialogue with the theory of the case on what kind of company do we want. That's values-driven, it's purpose-driven. And for everyone listening to the podcast, no matter where you might be in your career, you want to join great firms and companies that care deeply about the people agenda. The people agenda should be sacred ground. It shouldn't be trampled. You should work for leaders that care deeply about others, and then you can do great work. I am not naive that Michael and I and our teams have been able to do great work at Johnson & Johnson because we're on the shoulders of legends before us. J&J is 135 years. Our job is to leave J&J in a much better place for the next generations, for the next 135 years, to take it to the next place. I want a caring company. I want a company that is really committed to their employees. And that's what's great about J&J. That's what's great about our creator. That's what's wonderful about our purpose. I always try to give people career advice. Join companies whose values match yours. And if you do that, then the rest is sort of, you know, you can navigate, you can problem solve, you're going to have good bosses, you're going to have average bosses, you're going to stumble, you're going to make mistakes. Man, if you're working in a company that cares deeply about others and respects the people agenda as an HR pro, there's no limits. It's just what you place on yourself. So think caring, think courage. And I think that's where people need to think about, or how they need to think about their careers, I think, moving forward.
Peter and Michael, this has been an incredible conversation. So valuable. Thank you both for taking the time and sharing your wisdom about talent, future of work, and really creating a values-based organization.
Thanks for having us, JP. We love your podcast. Keep doing what you're doing. It's important to get the word out to all of our HR professionals around the world.
Thanks, JP.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Peter and Michael for sharing their insights on how CHROs and heads of talent can best partner to build talent pipelines and the future of work. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe, share a podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. And I'd love to hear from you as well. Feel free to drop me a line on LinkedIn. Let me know your ideas and how I can make the future of HR even better. We'll be back next week with two of the three authors of Work Different, 10 Truths for Winning the People Age. I'll be joined by Kate Bravery, an organizational psychologist who leads Mercer's Insight and Advisory Agenda, and Ilya Bonick, who's Mercer's Head of Strategy. In my conversation with Kate and Ilya, we're going to discuss how work is changing and why you should think of employees as contributors instead of workers, how you can build a culture that emphasizes empathy and places skills at the heart of change, and how AI will help us to amplify our intelligence and productivity. This is a great conversation and one that you won't want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.